Hi, I'm Kim.
I'm Tora.
And this is our podcast, Parenting Young Adults with Kim and Tora. Thank you so much for joining us today. Today we have a number of topics that we wanted to discuss. And we're going to start off by talking about this subject of being on code, which is something that I routinely say white people are always on code and that Black people would just be so much better off if we could just get on code too. And you had some input about that, Tora?
I sure did. I mean, I saw a video and hopefully, you know, once we continue to talk about this, you'll be able to explain to them the video that we're showing about being on code, because at this point in time in our life, I feel like it's so much on the internet, it's so much on social media. I mean, and we all are having these conversations and we're all fed up. So how is, and when I say we are all, I'm talking about Black people. How are we not on code yet? How? Like, how is it that we can, you know, see stuff, know stuff, and not, I'm not saying give us a pass. If we've done something absolutely wrong and criminal, no one wants a pass for that. No one wants anybody to get a pass for that. But I'm just talking about the simple things in life, you know, mistakes that you can make, whether it's a speeding ticket getting pulled over by a Black cop, or, you know, whether it's, you know, you go to the store and somebody, you know, you didn't pay for something that you thought the cashier might have rang up, or whatever it could be. I'm just, not off the top of my head, I can think of all the stuff that we can get a pass for, but we are not. And I'm just thinking of, you know, just different things that I've seen on social media that Black people with other Black people, we're just not getting a pass for. And it's like, we have no compassion for each other. Like, I feel like there's, you know, the video that we're talking about where the white guys talk about how they go to work, you know, and they can be the most lackadaisical people at work and they know it. And they know it. And their employers know it. But they'll get a raise. They'll get, you know, higher ranking. They'll get a bigger position. Everything. And I just feel like with us, we make one mistake. We call in too much. We're late for work. And it could be legitimate things, not something, you know, that's not legitimate. We could be limit. You could have car trouble. You could have, you know, kids, anything. No, you're causing the, you know, the business too much money. You know, you're not bringing what you need to bring to the table to make our company successful. But then this other person is doing even worse, who happens to be of another nationality, and they get raises, they get promotions, and they get to fly through the system, and they know it. And the video will show it. You know, the video shows it.
I think that being on code is bigger than just getting a pass. And I think that being on code means that at all times we are Black first. And I think that this video shows that as well. It's not just on the job or on the bank. They get a pass for criminal activity. Mm-hmm. It is not only giving you a pass when you mess up, it is giving you a hand up when you need it. It is always looking for ways to benefit our fellow Black people. And I think that with the conditioning and the programming that we've been subjected to here in this country in particular, we've been taught the same thing that everybody else has been taught, which is to always suspect ulterior motives or improper motives from a Black person. Whereas they're taught, as soon as you see one of us, you give them the benefit of the doubt. So it's a whole rearranging of the way we think of each other. And again, I would say, I'm not mad at Black people for not being able to do it. What's because of the I know how intense the programming has been, but it is time to wake up. It is time to start consciously thinking about, that's my brother, that's my sister, those are my people. What's within my power to do to make it better for them? How can I help them? And so on code is just all the time like that Black first thing. Mm-hmm. You're always thinking Black first, Black first. But it also extends to giving a pass and things like that. I was gonna show some of this video, but before we did, I just wanted to talk about Black versus African-American. Because I also sent you a video. Absolutely. Where Mother Tynetta Muhammad, I want to say. Yes. And she did a whole video on whether we should be considered Black or African American. And her position was that before the 80s or 90s, when we were just Black, that connected us to every other melanated person
that looked like us.
Globe, because there are Blacks in Africa, there are Blacks in the Philippines, in Indonesia, everywhere, China, there are Blacks everywhere.
Italians,
And so that gives us a global identity.
And I was saying Trinidadians, because I also saw last night where this woman, it's from the clipping of the Hidden Colors, the series, where this woman had on her passport that Trinidad people were listed as Caucasians. And she's like, I just don't date Black men from the United States. And he was like, what do you mean you're not Caucasian? She's like, oh yeah. She went home on her lunch break, got her passport and came back and showed him she was Caucasian. And it was like, so everyone other than
unconscious, that is so unconscious and so sleep. And it actually demonstrates how easily manipulated we are.
Yeah.
You don't identify by what somebody writes on a piece of paper or a passport about you. You look within and look at your outside and look at the people around you. I don't care what they write on my passport.
I believe I was poisoned by the system of feeling like the definition of Black, if you ever look up the definition, or anyone who's listening looks up the definition of Black, it is so dark, so degrading, so negative. So I felt like that is not a description of me. So when people would say, are you all Black or are you Black? I would say I'm brown. No, I'm brown. And even when I said anything about being a Black person, it was always brown. But I never credited the race of Black. I always said, you know, I love Black men. I love Black culture. You know, I love being around Black people. I've always said that, but when it came to just me and mine, it was always brown. So,
you know, that's interesting, because in the global world, in the world, brown people are not us. Brown people are Latinos. They are darker skinned Indians, like from India. They are people like that. And we're not that, and we're something else. Like, even our light skinned people are not considered Black, brown. That's why they're always talking about, which I don't agree with, Black and brown coalitions, because they're talking about Black people and brown people. I think I have always identified as Black because, as I told you before, when I came up post civil rights, there were so many things. Like, I think I was considered young, gifted, and Black.
Okay.
So we were, you know, everything was, we were just Black. That's how we identified ourselves. And that's what I claimed. And I think that Mother Tynetta Muhammad, I believe that's her name, is correct. And she said that once we narrowed it down and allowed ourselves to be called African American, then it isolated us. Now we're no longer the same as those Aborigines in Australia or the Aborigines in the Philippines or whatever. Now we're just this separate group over here. We're Africans in America. So I have always identified as Black. Truthfully, I've always accepted the moniker of African American as well. I accept Africans in America. I accept a lot of that, but I think that fundamentally, I've always known I was Black. Mm-hmm. Now, I watched another video which talked about what you said and said that the definition of Black is so negative. And then this woman was saying it means nothing. It's dark. It's this, it's that. And my immediate reaction was, that's what they say. I actually don't have to look in a dictionary to know what Black is. I can look at myself, my friends, my dates, my family. I know what Black is. So how about maybe we just move away from the dictionary and decide what we want to be? And some people may not want to be Black. You know, they're foundational Black Americans. There are those who say they're Native American. I mean, they're Hebrew, Israelites. Some of it would be just to figure out what we are. But it's possible that that Black label can group all of those together and you could still splinter off.
During this awoke period that we're in, Black and the color and the, and the, you know, how they say you look up in the definition and you're the picture of something. The picture of what Black looks like would resonate across the globe, but because it says African American, it limits to, no, that's just what those people look like
in America. And so I think that's a really good idea that we can define what it is we want it to be and apply it across the globe in the same way they claim that our people claim that they adopted the term nigger or nigger, all that stupid, whatever.
Yeah.
Then maybe we can adopt something that's actually useful and gives us a global identity and connects us with Africans and everybody in the diaspora, and we're all Black and we join together. And so I know you want to see the video. We're going to include a link to the video in the description box. This is just something I stumbled upon. I shared it with a number of people, including Tora, and we're all just fascinated by how much these Caucasian people actually reveal about what it means to be white in America in this video. And it's called Whitewashed: Unmasking the World of Whiteness. Okay, so the first topic that they talk about in this video is about the immigrants that came from the various European countries and how they shed their identities from their previous country in order to identify as white here and to get the benefits that being white would bestow upon them. And so the first question they ask is, where did white people come from?
I think a lot of it was early assimilation in the United States, a lot of European ethnics coming over, assimilating for a variety of reasons. Primary one being a desire to elevate their socioeconomic status. So to get jobs, to find places to live, a lot of the Europeans altered their last names to sound more mainstream. A lot of them changed the clothing that they wore, the foods they ate. So there was this, some might call it assimilation. I think of it more as Anglo-conformity, conforming to this kind of dominant white culture.
But the reality is that those persons who are white and who are considered white and treated as such in this society, by virtue of being white and treated that way, have had to give up who they really were.
And so we really encourage you to watch this, because you have candidly people coming from Ireland, from Germany,
France,
from all kinds of places.
They were proud to be from where they were from. They were so proud, but they, I guess, were tricked, you know? I don't know if it's indoctrinated.
I think they were tricked. I think they willingly accepted
it. They willingly accepted that, hey, we're not going to be all these different nationalities. We're just going to consider ourselves white people. And that's when I'm like, oh my God, I cannot believe they were willing to just, you know, shed who they were, as we did. We didn't get the opportunity. We were forced, but they actually gave up the opportunity to say, hey, I'm Jewish, I'm German, I'm French, you know, I'm from Australia, or wherever they were and migrated here for a better life or a new opportunity. They gave it all away. And I'm thinking, how do you do that when ours was stripped? We didn't want to give ours away. Ours was forced, but they willingly. So what leverage was sold to them to make them think, okay, well, we'll bank on this white thing?
White supremacy. That's what they talk about throughout the whole.
But that's so, what I'm saying is, as a human, if someone told me, okay, we're going to go to another country, and once you get there, all you have to do is say you're white, but you have to forget that you're German. You have to forget that you're, you know, from Great Britain. You have to forget that you're from all these other countries, and you have all these different nationalities or whatever, but you only can identify with being white. Like, to me, if somebody, or Black, somebody told that, I'm like, no, not knowing what I know. Like, no, I have the opportunity. I can still be German. Like, I can still be French. And you're telling me to shave all that, forget my culture, just go along this ride and wave. Like, I would never want to do that willingly. We as Black people were stripped of that. We don't have our own names. We don't have our own religion. We don't have our own, you know, anything, you know, family structure, meals, food, whatever. We don't have our own. We were stripped, robbed of that, but they were willingly just gave that up.
I didn't get that from the video. I didn't get what you got from the video. What I got from the video was an inside glimpse of white supremacy, what people did to participate in it, how they benefit from it, and how it constantly is used to oppress us.
Well, I think to be white in this culture means to deny the reality of racism. And it means to deny the privilege that we have as whites.
If you're white in this country, there's certain advantages that come your way, and it doesn't really matter whether you want to or not, or whether you're in touch with it or not.
Now, I know there are privileges that I enjoy simply because I'm white.
Every minute of my life, I'm aware of my white privilege, of the fact that I have a white skin, and that with that white skin comes along a whole mess of privileges that I have, and I don't ask for them, they just are there.
There are things that come to me, that belong to me, that I'm given and that I expect just because I'm white.
What they're showing us in this video is how white supremacy oppresses us and unfairly elevates them. There's nothing to feel sorry about. They're oppressing us.
They said, do you identify with being white? And I'm like, no. No. Almost every last one was like, no. Like, in their own personal skin, they didn't like that. They love saying, no, I'm not white. I'm Italian. No, I'm not white. I'm German. Yeah, I'm Russian. Yeah, I'm, you know, all these other things.
That's not what I got from this. And when they were saying, no, I don't feel white and I don't think about being white, they were talking about the privilege of not having to consider race every day in every way. And so they were saying things like, yeah, I know my skin's white. I know I'm white, but I never have to think about that.
I really didn't think about being white, I'd say, growing up, because mainly, I think, because I was part of the majority and I maybe wasn't forced to think about it.
How often do you think about being white?
Not very often. I really don't think about it a lot at all.
Hardly ever.
I don't know if I ever considered myself white or thought about it. At one point, I'm sure I did, but I don't really have any recollection of when it was, which I think is a total reflection of whiteness, of never having to sort of contemplate why people treat you the way they do.
To be white means to be a member of a dominant racial group in a society that I'd consider white supremacist. And to be white in a white supremacist society, not just a racist society, because that's almost too generic, to be white in a white supremacist society is to be able to have the luxury of oblivion, to be oblivious to the injustices, to be oblivious to racial privilege, to be oblivious, frankly, to one's own identity.
But they were like, we never had to think about that. It's like we always think about being Black because people always react to us as Black people. They were just saying, that's not something I have to think about. I know I'm white, but I don't have to think about it every day.
I've never, up until recent years, and I'm talking about, I'm not even giving myself 5 good years. I'm not even giving myself that long. I've never seen myself as a Black woman, Black person. I've only been a woman. I've only been a person. The last
brown. You said you were brown. Right. You identify with the brown people of color.
Not the brown people, just me. You know, if you said anything, you know, about anything Black, I would be like brown. I would say brown. You know, or there was a brown girl in school, or there was a brown girl at work. You know, it was never, and she wasn't brown, meaning Latino. No, she was looked just like me, but I never considered her Black. I always said brown. So for me, I've walked in those shoes a long time. And now that I'm like, literally like walking in the shoes of Blackness, I'm not going to lie to you. I feel the weight of the world. And I'm like, how long has everybody else been woke and felt this weight?
Everybody else is not woke. Just people just saying that they're Black or not woke. Like, I don't consider myself woke. I'm not woke.
No, you've always been woke, though.
I'm not woke at all. I don't call myself woke.
You've always known who you were. You've always known what you love about yourself. And you've always known that there were people out there who might not see you as just a woman, but see you as a Black woman. That, to me, is woke. I literally just walked on this path of, so every day I walk out this house, I'm seen as a Black woman. And not just a woman. And I took that for granted. I did not stop. And so when I heard those people speak, like, no, I am something else, you know, and they asked them, are you, do you think about being white? Or, you know, how do you feel being white? I took that as in the same way as, like, if someone was to ask me, well, do you think about being Black? No, I didn't. How do you feel about being Black? Well, the definition of it, I'm not that. But now that I realize it's not even about the definition, it's about the struggle, the culture, the attitude, the everything that we get from the other races who have been taught to, you know, think of us as lesser people, Black people as lesser people. I feel that now. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. And I'm fighting diligently with this, you know, podcast and everything to bring light to it because I don't like it. I'm like, so somebody who's felt what I'm feeling their whole life.
And has felt that. I don't feel that every day. I don't feel that every day. I don't feel Blackness as a weight. I don't feel it. I don't feel what you're talking about. I don't feel that. And I don't know that I ever
feel it as a weight because I take on other people's burdens. Like if I see there was just a Black man who just got pulled over again and was murdered again by a trove of Caucasian men again. And I'm like, how many times do we have to see this story that for us to react? I feel that weight. I feel the weight that there was a Black girl who went to a Caucasian police station and said she had been raped. I feel that weight.
So you're telling me that before you start doing this podcast and start viewing yourself as a Black person, that you never identified with the victims of police brutality and racism that are flashed across social media all the time?
I can tell you the day it hit me. The day it hit me was the hardest. And the day it gut-wrenched me was Tamir Rice. That's the day I stayed up all night and cried. I heard 12-year-old boy playing in the park. I had little brothers that I didn't buy them guns, but my mom did, little toy guns, like Nerf guns or water guns. They played in the park, you know, they played outside with those guns. And I when I heard that he was 12 and I saw the video of him complying, they said, hands up, drop your weapon. He did everything. And within a matter of seconds, he was gone. And no one is punished for killing this child. That's when I realized if that had been a white kid, an Asian kid, or any other kid, it would have never come to that. It would have went to the park. Hey, is that a real gun? No. Well, get out of the park. You're scaring people.
So it all came to you about 7 years ago. Because he was killed in 2014.
Yeah. After that, my eyes were awake to every single atrocity that happened, and it hurts every single time the same way. And I see my kids, I see myself, I see my spouse, I see my friends, I see all of us now. At first, I thought, you know, if I did hear, okay, so let's start back with Rodney King, right? Mm-hmm. What did you hear? You know, I saw the beating. I was upset. Yeah,
Black man was hyped up on some illegal drugs, and the cops beat the crap out of him on the theory or the excuse that those drugs prevented him from controlling himself. And really, what they really showed, they really suggested, was that he was acting like a wild animal, so they had no choice but to beat the pulp out of him.
And then you hear he gets this large settlement for millions of dollars, and then that's it, right?
That's when he comes back and screws up again.
Right. So this is the story I'm hearing. That's the lifestyle I'm living. Like, okay, well, this is just Black man. He's high. I've already seen all these other, you know, documentaries where if you're on that stuff, you know, you do horrible things to people. You can rip handcuffs apart and break them apart. You know, you can climb up walls. Like, I'm already watching these type of programs growing up.
Propaganda that is not true, but you didn't know that at the time.
Oh, I was way too young. I'm like from 10... 11, 12 years old, little girl watching all, because my parents always watch those type of documentaries. So we're watching those and I'm watching those and I'm saying, you know, okay, so now then the Rodney King thing happens.
In 1991.
And then you get the O.J. Simpson trial, okay? And now I'm still asleep, but they're nudging me to wake up. And I'm watching this trial. And
so you're saying you were around 10 or 11 in 1991?
No. Before then, before Rodney King trial, my parents, when I was younger, would watch all, like, you know, it wasn't CNN back then, but it was probably like Dateline or some type of Dateline show where I would always sit at the foot of the bed and watch it with them. But it was always, you know, documentaries of what drugs do and PCP and how strong it was. That was when I was that young. Okay. So those images were always in my mind, you know, like seeing, you know, a naked black man fighting in the hallway of a police station, beating the police up with their own batons and breaking handcuffs off. Those were the images that were always stuck in my mind.
You saw that?
Oh yeah, those things traumatized me. So at 10, 9 years old, when I saw that kind of stuff, it stayed in my brain. So as I got older, and I hear that Rodney King is on PCP and he was acting like a wild animal and they had to beat him. In my mind, of course, I'm like, dang, like that though? It took all of y'all to do that? But I understand because I've already been shown what that kind of drug can do if you get out of hand. So then I hear him say, can we all get along? And I'm like, oh, well, he's fine. And he's not even holding a grudge. And then I hear him get paid. So, okay, I move on. And like I said, then you fast forward to the O.J. Simpson trial, and I'm watching this trial.
It was in 1995. It was in October of 1995.
And I'm watching the trial. I mean, from the beginning opening statement to the end closing statement, never missed a day, watched it all. And I remember midway through it, I was still feeling, God, this woman was taken from her children. God, this woman was taken from her children. That's midway through it. By the end of the O.J. Simpson trial, I don't know. I don't know what media outlet I was on. I don't know what people were talking around me. I don't know, but it put something in my brain that I wanted O.J. to win this trial, but I also was afraid for him to win the trial. And it was because of the backlash that I knew was going to come. I don't know how I knew it, but I knew. And I knew they weren't going to just let him get away with it at all. I knew it. So when they said not guilty, I wasn't one of the people that jumped up and screamed, oh my God. I kind of knew he was going to, you know, win that trial. I kind of knew. But at the end of the day, I remember that's when I transitioned over to, because I heard all of these people after going, finally, we got one. All these years of us fighting the system and being, you know, neglected by the system and being, you know, wrongfully by the system. We got one. And I was just like, oh, wow. Okay. All right. So that's how this happened. Okay. So I moved on. And then we go to all the other killings. We go to, you know, every I don't even want to give the names because when I do, it gives the person who hurt them or killed them, you know, the credit too. But the one I will share is the Tamir Rice one.
Okay.
I will say Trayvon.
Very early on.
Trayvon definitely hurt me because I definitely heard him screaming for his life. I was pissed off that a man was saying it was him screaming for his life when you know a black voice and a black child's voice when you hear it. So Trayvon, Tamir Rice were the ones that scalded me the most and made me
Trayvon Martin was 2012. Mm-hmm. So that's about 17 years after O.J. Simpson, mm-hmm. about 9 years ago.
So that's when, and then from that point on, you know, the snowball effect picks up everything that goes along and gets bigger and bigger and bigger. That's where I've come now. And
so at what point did you, so you're saying that back in 2012 with Trayvon Martin, in 2014 with Tamir Rice is when you begin to identify with the victim more so or no?
Not only identify with the victim, but feel the anger and the compassion and the wrongfulness that I'm supposed to feel, that I was supposed to feel. It was no excuse of anything. It was no excuse of me feeling like, okay, so I know you probably remember, because we love comedy, Chris Rock saying, it's not, you know, the police that he fears going to the ATM. It's not, you know, it's us, you know. So that's the lifestyle that I think.
So for you, you were more convinced of the danger and criminality of black people, so you didn't really identify with them because you more so feared what they might do to you.
Wrongfulness. I didn't identify the wrongfulness of You know, I believe that if the police had to arrest someone or, you know, struggle to arrest someone, it was because that person was absolutely, you know, out here doing wrong. But now that we have social media and we can see it from the beginning to the end, that it's just people who have been driving along and been had evidence planted on them. Not only have they had evidence planted on them, but they've been tortured, killed, all of that, you know, and it's like you cannot deny the fact that it's real, you know.
That is so interesting to me. So you're saying that in the old days before the social media and the cameras and all that, when you would hear that a Black guy killed or pummeled near to death during a traffic stop or something like that, you would be thinking, you wonder what they did wrong. They must have been on drugs. They must have committed a crime, something like that.
100%, that was where my heart was. 100%.
So it's really interesting because truly, I've said before that previously I had a veil over my eyes. Now, I've always known that I was Black. I've always enjoyed, I don't know why to tell you that I enjoyed it. There's a spirituality, a soul, a connection, a just a vibrancy to being Black that I would never have traded for anything else. But just like everybody else, there was some level of veil over my eyes where I just couldn't see the kinds of things that are clear to me right now. But part of the reason I believe that I don't like the news is because when I was just a toddler, I believe that I saw Black and white news because it was on TV, and those news shows showed white people, police in particular, using big fire hoses, this was the civil rights era, using big fire hoses on Black people. I saw Black people sitting in just wanting to eat at the restaurant and shop at the place. I saw Black people unleashing attack dogs. I saw white people unleashing attack dogs on Black people, just peaceful Black people. But somehow I saw people throwing rocks and sticks and spitting. I saw schools trying to be integrated and white people chanting and calling Black people the N-word. Little kids, grown white people calling little kids the N-word and blocking their path and needing the National Guard to come and escort the Black people. So I think it did a couple things to me. I think the one thing it did was make me hate the news. Mm-hmm. I've never liked the news. And there was a period when I was practicing law and working at the firms that I actually felt a little bad about that, because they'd be talking about this robbery, rape, murder, and I'd be like, I don't know, I didn't hear it, whatever. And sometimes I'd be like, you need to get more informed to myself. Mm-hmm. Now I'm so grateful I never did, because it blocked a lot of the programming that the news is witchcraft all day. It is programming all day long. That's what it is. That's what it's designed to be. And so I escaped a large percentage of the programming. I mean, I still got it through the movies and the music, and I'm not insinuating that they programmed me too, but I didn't get it from the news. The other thing that it did was to make me feel a way about white people. Now, when I grew up in inner city DC, there's a white man on the two doors down, there's a white family right down the street. It had been a white neighborhood, but it had transitioned over to being Black, but there were still some whites left. We were friends with them. Mr. Ed, the guy three doors down with the pit bulls and stuff, would come, and all of the, you know, I'd say, hey, Mr. Ed, you left your keys in the car. He bought me a bag of candy. We were all cool. But in my mind, I understood that white people are mean to us. They don't want to treat us fair. They oppress us. They hold us down. They will sick dogs and not Mr. Ed, but the other white people will do all of those things. And you know, the one thing watching that whitewashed video did for me was to remind me of how many decent white people I actually have met in my life, because I went to Wisconsin for college. That's all white people and a little tiny chunk of black people. And became best friends with my roommate, which I think I've mentioned on here. We even went and got an apartment later. Mm-hmm. There were deans who looked out for me, put me on boards, gave me references. You know, I went to law school and up in the Northeast with all white people, just a tiny bit of black people. I worked at those law firms, 1-2% black. Now I've known a lot of really horrible white people, but I also have known some good ones. And I also have known some, especially in Wisconsin, some really liberal ones who felt it was their mission to right the wrongs that were going on against black people. So this video there's a white man that I do some of my cases with sparingly. I don't do these all the time, but if it's a big enough one, I will call him in. He works at a bigger firm and we'll work it together. I just think he's the greatest guy. He's upstanding. He talks to me about Trump, about racial disparity. The video just reminded me that, you know, there are a lot of white people who know the privilege they have, who know they don't deserve it, who know how negatively it affects us, and who actively try to fix it. Mm-hmm. And so the video was a welcome reminder to me. Now, having been up close and that personal with white people, I know that even some of these kind of people will turn on you when it hits the fan and you're black and you're white. But then this morning I thought, but even some black people turn on you when it hits the fan.
How I was raised. So if you're raised feeling like it's evenly yoked, it's hard to actually see past that there's a system out there that's plotted directly against us. And I felt like, so when I was growing up, I never saw the assassination of Martin Luther King or President Kennedy ever. It wasn't until I remember the age I was 22 when I saw the movie, saw the autobiography and biopic, and they played it back to back. And so when I saw it, I was traumatized by both, but it was still evenly yoked for me. Like there are just bad people in the world. And all the stories, like I've heard stories where black people's like, I was chased home by white people and they threw rocks at us. For me, I had an altercation when we were younger with white boys and my sister and I, but I didn't look at them as white boys chasing black girls. I looked at them as white boys trying to chase black girls just chase us. Like they were after us. And what happened was, I think my sister and her friends had gone into their yard to retrieve a bike that was one of the other girls who was Caucasian. And the guy was like, no, that's my bike. So when he saw my sister and I later on that day, they were running after us. And so I completely stopped. I was like, why am I running? So she was like, keep running. And I was like, no, why am I running? She was like, oh, because they think we stole their bike. And I was like, what? So I stopped running. He's like, oh, well, you weren't one of the people that were with them earlier. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, someone came in my yard and took my brother's bike. I was like, well, I don't have anything to do with that. My sister doesn't. He was like, no, she was there. So I was like, saying to my sister, what's going on? She's like, oh, their brother stole their bike and they saw it in the yard and they went and got it back. And so he's trying to say it's his bike. Never in a million years did I associate that incident with three white guys chasing me and my sister.
It doesn't sound like a racial incident.
Right.
It doesn't sound like it had anything to do with race. It had to do with the stolen property and who had it and who does it belong to. And they didn't mess with you once they realized you weren't a part. That wasn't about race. And I wanted to clarify, I grew up in inner city Washington, D.C. Race wasn't an issue in my everyday life. My friends were black. Most of the people in my surrounding area were black. There were the whites in my area, just one, I don't even remember one white girl in our school, but my best friend from high school was reminding me that she had an exchange student live in her home. And that exchange student, if I'm not mistaken, went to school with us. She was from some European country. Yeah. But we had white teachers.
Right.
And we had a, now I think about all the stereotypical cultural racism. There was a Jewish store in our neighborhood where we bought stuff. And, you know, my grandmother was very, had a great relationship with them, would send me to the, with my dog to the store to get stuff and bring it back. And she would call him and whatever, but they were Jewish looking back. Every piece of candy that everywhere else would cost 5 cents, mm-hmm. those Jewish people charged us 6 cents. Mm-hmm. Every piece of candy that will cost 10 cents, their price was 12 cents. And you may be thinking that's a penny or two, but that added up significantly over the years. And I see that as symptomatic of the type of relationship that Jewish people have had with our Black neighborhoods. But staying to the point, white people weren't a big presence in my life. I mean, the doctor was Middle Eastern or something, but I didn't think about it on a day-to-day basis. But somehow, because of those news clippings, because of conversations that I heard grown-ups having, I always understood that white people do stuff to Black people, not because something's wrong with Black people, not because Black people are doing something wrong, but this is how white people are.
My grandmother experience at all. And even to present day, I feel like I still have not had that experience at all. So whenever I do see it on social media and I do see what people like, if they're able to capture it from the beginning to, and it's not provoking. I do not support getting pulled over by the police and just saying, you know, off the break, just being disrespectful. I just don't.
No, I agree with Joe. Like, make it pleasant, yeah. Comply, and then if you need to file a complaint later, you do that. But don't go all off on the man with the gun.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, it doesn't make sense.
So that's been my thing. So if I do see innocence, pure innocence, that's when I see, you know, not saying pure, but when I see innocence and it's been taken advantage of, just for somebody who woke up that morning feeling, you know, angry and sick about their life and want to project it on somebody else of another race, that has been gut-wrenching for me.
But you have been subjected to racism because you talked about it on this podcast.
Right.
You
right.
maybe just don't realize it.
No, I have. I definitely have.
Before here, when Tammy was on this podcast, mm-hmm. you and she talked about, and you in particular mm-hmm. talked about how your daughter would win the gymnastics competition, but they would take her trophy and they would give it to the white person just because they were white. Wow. You talked about how the white people would have parties and would not invite your daughters to participate. So it's okay. I'm not saying this to criticize you. What I'm saying is there was some cognitive dissonance that we all have. That's what's happening to you because you were Black by people who were white that were doing it because you were Black. That's racism. But somehow you were still able to be over here and not really, I don't know, connect the two things with white people.
What I'm saying is those incidents of racism that I felt because they were doing this to my family, I didn't grow up with that knowing that that's what that was. Like, if it did happen to me when I was younger, I never had it. I never felt it.
Once with it what happened to your daughters, what did you think it was? How did you process that?
It happened to my daughters. It was, I didn't tell them because I didn't want them. I wanted them to more so grow up like me, just thinking they were just horrible people. But for me, it was no doubt about it. Diabolically, it was racist. You know, that for me, but I would never say to them, wow, that's some racist stuff, or that's some racist, oh, they're just racist. I never did that. But for me, I sat there and I was angry and I had to try to figure out a way to beat them at that same game without losing my mind, because it was definitely my awoken period. Like, I was waking up as I'm watching my children be great at something and me bringing it to the forefront, me saying to their coach, who's Asian, who didn't even know what Black skin was. I had to tell her, and her husband had to translate, who also was Chinese. I had to say to him, you know, I brought all of these people to your gym. You're making tons of money because of me. And now you're letting these people come in who happen to be of another nationality and buy you things and taunt you and, you know, dangle. But don't you know there's no loyalty there? Like I'm loyal. And then once, you know, she didn't get it, I had to leave. And then I realized that racism is just, it is what it is.
You know, just listening to you, when you would talk about growing up in Annapolis and being in a multicultural environment and that sort of thing, and this conversation that we're having right now makes me realize how blessed I was to be born and raised in DC. Mm-hmm. Because back then, DC was Chocolate City.
All day.
And when I came outside, I mean, there were some white kids, but those white kids, they didn't come outside and play with us, but we knew them, we spoke to them, we waved and stuff.
They weren't in your
school. I didn't go to the school. I don't know where they went to school. We walked, back then, we walked to the neighborhood elementary school, we walked to the junior high school. I guess, I don't know where they went. They might've gone there, but I don't remember, actually.
My daughter, and this couldn't be more than 2.5 years ago. My daughter saw my little nephew's picture in school that my brother had taken. He lives in Atlanta, and he had taken the picture, and he doesn't even forget the day. My kids were like, he goes to school with all those black kids?
But I don't get that with your kids, because the school that they went to was primarily black. I mean, well, it wasn't. It was mixed. It was black, it was white, and now they're having a lot more Latinos. But in that environment, my kids both had, well, my daughter had white friends earlier, and she did have a Brazilian friend. So they've had, and a mixed friend. So they've had mixed friends, but they didn't really date that much, but dating's been black. Yeah. Their main friends have been black. I think that as they got older, they got away from having white friends and got more into just having black friends. They've had white friends, but it was a multicultural experience for them. But your kids didn't have that. Your kids had some white experience at that school. When my kids had a multicultural experience. Yeah. I don't know how or why.
I think it's just the upbringing. You're a product of your environment. They're around gymnastics 8 hours plus a day, every single day, all year long.
Your kids were attracted to white boys, because both of my kids are aware that each of your, because they're in the same grades.
And even my son, he says, I'm only gonna date black women. It's not like my son even has a preference. He will date whoever like he feels he's attracted to. It's not like, you know, there's some men that are like, no, a black woman is only the apple of my eye, or, you know, some black men might even.
It's only like black dating interests. I think my daughter tried to date white. It didn't feel white. I don't know that my son's ever tried it. I don't know. It's just as bizarre to me that they could spend time in the same high school. I don't know if your daughter went to middle school. Went to middle school with my daughter. She was in PVA for choir, chorus.
They did dance and, they had a dual one for middle school. They did dance and I forget the other one, but they had
chorus PVA, but they came out just as black as ever. But I think that my upbringing allowed me not to really, like, I knew the outside world was white and that they were racist, but my inner world wasn't that much of a problem. Some of the white teachers from time to time were a problem, but they were white, and I don't know how to explain it. It was a black world that I grew up in. So when I went to Wisconsin, it was a total culture shock, because it was a totally white world. But I mean, you know, I did fine and made friends and everything. And I started liking foreigners there, because I always did work study, and I worked in the foreign student office or whatever that's called. And I made friends with Indonesians, with a lot of Africans. I started really liking people of other nationalities then. That was no problem. And white people were, I had white friends, we hung out, we drank, we did all kinds of stuff. But I don't know, I think it was a blessing to be raised in a black city.
It was. I think you get to see a certain point of life earlier, and you don't have to have so much of a shock when you see it, because you already know it's there. For me, everything is a shock.
And so we were shielded, because my grandmother migrated from South Carolina. She was the oldest of us hassle, as they used to say, of children. And so her siblings, her brothers and sisters came up here with her. And so they all had children, all their children had children. So we would congregate at my aunt's house for weekends, and my grandmother would take me to her sister's because those are her siblings. So it was like a fence of protection around me of Black people and Black environments. And it's a blessing. Listening to, it was a village and it was a blessing and it was a protection. And I guess by the time I went to the white world, I blended in with them. I told you, I even began talking. I remember coming home and saying, and they were like, what? What are you talking about, Kim? The dog or whatever it is that I might've been saying. But I never went so far as to say pop. I always say soda, but I blended right in with them, but I think maybe it was because I was comfortable and assured of who I was.
Black culture from the beginning, and not something fake, like you just all of a sudden learn it. Now you're going to dive in it and you're just going to just run around screaming, you know, I'm Black and I'm proud. I'm not saying that's fake, but I'm just saying, I believe that if you're born into it, and it's you're brought up in it and you know about it from the start, it's just so much easier to walk through life than when you find out that there's a whole race war going on and you're in the middle of it and you didn't even know it.
That could be, I can imagine that would be quite jarring, because it's a paradigm shift that sort of pivots the whole way you have been viewing the world, and you are total grown up with young adults. I mean, you know, or at that time, older kids. And I imagine, and you know, the other thing is that even as in Wisconsin, we melded and meshed with other people, it also made the Black kids stick together more. So I had groups of friends that were just Black. We just got, well, first of all, at some point I joined the sorority. So there was all that Blackness with all the sororities and fraternities. But even before that, we would meet up in each other's dorm rooms. There was just like a core group of us that we would hang together because we were Black. And there were a couple people from my high school in that group, believe it or not. And so one of my line sisters went to my same high school. We weren't necessarily friends in high school, because I was that one who would straddle the line. I would go in the class and know all the smart kids because I was really smart. But I'd go out back and know all the hip kids because I was really that too.
Part of that.
So So sometimes we get report cards and the cool kids would be like, how did you get those grades? Remember when I said I have to go to class because I have an exam and y'all stayed out here? You know what I mean? So I would straddle those lines, but we weren't really friends in high school because I more so hung with the cool kids. Mm-hmm. But when we got to college, I knew them and there was that connection, and we became that. My line sister from my high school and I were like this for about 3 years, just tight. Even as I was tight with my roommate, I don't know how to explain it. I guess I had several best friends because my roommate and I were tight. That was my girl all the way till she left because she didn't finish there. But it's bizarre, because you would think that the upbringing you had where you were mixing would have offered you more protection because you would have been able to deal with both sides. But I think in those early years, being raised in that Black cocoon,
you know what resonated with me is when the teacher said in the video that you showed that I look at the white students more than I look at the Black students. And
she tried to fix it and it was hard for her to do it.
And I feel like I had to try to look back and ever felt like that happened to me. And I looked hard and I could not find one time in my high school, middle school, or elementary school year where I felt like they weren't looking at me. I felt like they were looking at me. When I went back in my mental Rolodex to look, I felt like they were looking at me too much. Like, good God, look at somebody else, you know? Like, stop looking at me. I felt like, and that mentally messed me up too, because I felt like, now, did I feel that way because they were overcompensating because they were people like the teachers in the clique? Or was I just part of the crowd? Was I part of the, literally I was best friends with one of my teachers in high school and middle school. My one teacher was great and good friends with all my kids except for one, which I knew that one wasn't gonna mesh well, which is my Mia. But my son and my daughter, we all had the same teacher. And
you had her or him?
I had him. I had him.
And your kids had him as well?
I had him.
That's crazy.
Victoria finally left middle school. We all took a picture together. Mia is not in the picture. She should have been, but I don't care that she wasn't because she wasn't one of his.
She didn't.
She was influenced by a lot of her friends because he was very like forthright. Mr. Griffins was the best teacher in the school for me. And he was a Caucasian man. I would leave the school, go get him and his friend their coffee, come back. I would go get them snacks from downtown Annapolis, then come back. And Victoria became, because then, you know, they had school lockdown. So she would just do the things that she could do inside the school, like go to the vending machines and go make him copies or go do whatever he needed to do. So he was, and my son was the same way. He loved all of us. And Victoria, he told me at the end, was his favorite. He was like, I thought she was my favorite, but Victoria Slick, and he nicknamed her Slick Vic, and that is her nickname.
Oh, that's her name on TikTok, right?
Yeah, and he nicknamed her Slick Vic, and he was like, I'm not gonna lie, I love Victoria the most.
As long as it's my kids, I'm okay. You can love them. I'm like, that's fine. But you know, I'm trying to think about it. All the teachers that I remember, like Mr. Butler, the science teacher in junior high was my favorite teacher, Mr. Graham. In high school, used to even give me rides home sometime because I went to school all the way across town. I think I have a lot of memories of Black teachers, and I had a lot of them. I think that some of the white teachers just came off as weird sometimes.
The only Black teacher I had was in elementary school, and I don't believe she's on earth. I despised her to the moment she closed her eyes. She was horrible to me. Mean to me, not nurturing to me, and sweet. And the woman that I thought I had as a teacher, because my sister had had her and my mother and her all connected, so I couldn't wait. I had this teacher. Oh my God, I had Mrs. Johnson. And when I got there, it was cold, evil, and mean. Okay. And I remember the last time I saw her, my mother and I were in the grocery store, and she said, do you remember her? She was your teacher. I was like, no, I don't remember at all. And I walked away. My mother got out of the car. She said, "What? Why did you act like that? I've never seen you." I said, Mom, that woman tortured me. She said, you never told me. I said, Mom, you would make me take those sweet potato pies to school for her. And I really wanted to like just chop them up and give them to her. She was like, you never told me that. I said, she made me take two, but my mother had made like five at different days. She only got two. The other ones, me and my friends would eat. I was like, y'all here, let's eat this. She would never see them.
I mean, I had Black teachers I couldn't stand. Black teachers that were so rude and always had something to say. Black teachers that I love, and ones that were just bizarre. Like, I remember my English teacher used to get on my nerves. Mm-hmm. But she was the one who used to say, you need to be a lawyer because you always have something.
My Caucasian teacher told me that, who I'm still, Mrs. Mellish, who I am still, and she loved my son. And she loved all my kids because she was a teacher to my son and I, but then she just saw my daughters because she went to the same school. But literally, she was the teacher. She was our history teacher, and she literally had this project where we had to become lawyers. And me and this other girl were supposed to be the head lawyers in the case, and I had mine all organized and everything, and I fought my case. And she sat me down. She's like, I'm telling you, if you don't go into broadcast or acting, I need you to become a lawyer. And that made me on such a natural high. Like, that was my, I wish I had more teachers going forward like her, but I didn't have them at all.
I remember that lady's name and I just won't call it, but oh, she used to get on my nerves. And back then, and I still am a person that people will just tell stuff to. And so I always back then wanted to be a psychologist because my friends would just come to me and tell me stuff. And I figured I had a knack for helping people. And I used to be like, Miss such and such is tripping.
Because that is true with
that word, or she's lunching because I am going to be and if I saw her today, I'd be like, guess what? I ended up being a lawyer. But we had weird teachers, like the physics teacher who wore a wig and was just so weird, and we had great teachers. Man, I had a lot of Black teachers, and those are the ones that stand out in my mind, but I know that I had white teachers as well.
Yeah, the one I did have was I had two, but they weren't really full-time teachers for me, but I had one that I talked to, and she became kind to me, but that was in the high school years. But the nurturing years, my elementary school years, the worst teacher was a Black woman. And I'm telling you, I don't know what it is. I don't know how that, but now, oh no. When my daughters had African-American teachers and principals and stuff, no, they were perfection.
I didn't feel like my children had enough Black teachers.
The ones they did have was perfection.
And then with my son in particular, I didn't feel that he had enough Black male teachers and that he had ever had enough of that, because he had been in the private school at first. And then when he went to the county school,
son had any.
I think he had enough. So I was thrilled when he went to the HBCU. And I know
he did have one. I forgot.
I know that he's had many now, men as well as women, and some of them suck so bad and some of them are good, but he's managed to get those grades no matter what. But it was just, I just wanted him to have some Black male teachers. Like, there's so many women teachers. And then at that school, most of the teachers, both male and female, were white.
Mm-hmm.
That just is the reality. Most of the teachers were white, and some of them got them. I had to straighten a few of them because don't get it twisted up in here, but you know, for the most part, it was a good experience.
Like, if I thought the experience was greater, like moving to an area where they would have more culture, I would have done that. But I felt like, you know, where they were getting great educations and it would take them further in life. But once you look back on life and you know that, it starts at home, but also it's out in the world too, that they can get it. I wish I had brought more culture in.
That high school was a good experience for my children because they had been in a private school at first, then they went to public middle school, but that high school was off the chain. And the way I raise my kids is a bit more sheltered than that. And so I feel that it was good for them to just see.
Not me.
All the array. I mean, from hanging out with rich white kids whose dad had a yacht, you know, to a friend in the projects my daughter had, who was a really sweet girl and an athlete. I would actually go pick her up and bring her over here so she could spend the night and have a different environment.
My kids didn't have that experience at all.
My kids had the whole gamut. From a mixed kid whose granddaddy was rich and even bought her a Jeep before she ever got a driver's license. They had the whole everything, even the ghetto people, like Tammy and I were talking about.
Kids that lived in urban and public housing at all, none.
My kids did. My daughter had that one friend. She was a good friend. And I'm telling you, I would bring that little girl over here and, you know, let her do whatever it was we were doing, calling myself, taking an interest in her. And she was a good friend to my daughter. And then my son was off the chain in those years. So he would go to those parties in those places. But at the same time, they had white and Black friends living in houses like we live in the county and stuff like that. So they had a great experience, and they experienced way more than I ever would have exposed them to myself. And they lived over here with all the other affluent Black kids whose mommy and daddies are lawyers and principals and dentists and all that. But they got that at that school, and it was just mind blowing to me. But one thing I want to mention about that video, I remember you telling me and Tammy that when they would steal your daughter's truck, you know, take your daughter's trophies unfairly and give them to white kids, and they were actually telling those white kids that they are never be as good as we are. And so I was shocked to see in that video that they didn't feel like that. Did you notice that? They didn't feel like, felt like
it's a badge of honor for them.
Yes, and it means we're entitled to more, and we just deserve it, and we expect it. And even though we're not doing much of anything, we know we're going to get it. But I thought
self thing for me. It was like each individual person felt like, look, I know you're giving me the world and everything in it, but I'm accepting of it. It was no, they wrote the rules. I'm just so happily a part of this, you know, train that's going their way. It was none of that. It was all self. Like, look, y'all wrote the rules and I'm so glad you wrote them because I'm so proud to be a part of this, you know, lifestyle that you provide.
Video.
Yeah, and I feel like we-
Surprise. I was surprised. I thought that some of them would feel what you said.
Yeah, no.
Because I can see those people outperform me in every area, but I get more than they get. So that must mean deep down that they're really better than me. And we just have this society that unfairly rewards me. But they didn't, if that's there, it must be buried way deep because they didn't seem-
It wasn't there. It wasn't there. And I believe that's the way of the world. I believe that's when I hear people say, and I've heard people say this in the past, but now I associate it with my future. Well, it's just the time we lived in. That's just the way things were back then. Now I hear it. I hear it. And I'm like, oh God, there it is. There it is. So they know it's just the way things were back then. And they know that it's just the times we lived in back then. However, they're accepting of it. Like, I feel like we as Black people just are never going to be acceptance of anything given to us that we didn't earn. And you can say, well, no, we're getting better at it. No, we're not getting better at it. Because if we were, we would allow all of us to share the wealth. I feel like even, that's why they call us crabs in a pot. Not other Black people call our own selves crabs in the pot, because when one of us try to get up, you got so many people trying to pull you down in the barrel to stay down with you.
But to me, that's a legacy of slavery. To me, that's a legacy of the programming. They have taught us that we don't deserve anything, that you can't trust other Blacks, that you can't, that Africans don't like us, that light-skinned people and dark-skinned people, they have taught us all those divisions to keep us warring, you know, small, like social wars with each other. And I don't think that that has anything to do with the way Black people really are. I think that that's just...
There was a letter sent out. This is a while ago, but there was a letter sent out to the Bloods and the Crips saying that they were going to kill 1,000 people by the end of a certain period. And Minister Farrakhan was saying, how do you all believe that a gangster actually sent the letter? And that it was from a gangster. Like, how are you all still believing? Why aren't anyone ripping up the letter going, y'all please, we ain't doing that. And I don't believe they did that. Like, how are we still programmed to be like, okay, oh, they want to kill us, or they want to kill 1,000 of us, or they want to come over. Like, how are we still
thinking they were going to do as a result of that letter?
That part I didn't hear the reaction from the letter, but he was more so getting on people saying, why are we still believing just because someone tells us that so-and-so hates us or so-and-so shot up your neighborhood, that that's true? How do you know when they can't find
the Bloods got a letter saying the Crips were going to do this, and the Crips got a letter saying the Bloods, so that's the stuff they do.
But how are we still programmed to believe that crab pot mentality? Why aren't we at this point in time in our life, now that we know that all that stuff can happen, why haven't we all just said, stop? Like, we're not believing it. No, we're not. We're not believing.
Look at the type of people that you're talking about there. And I don't mean to denigrate anybody, but you're talking about people that are consuming the fast food, eating all the crap, drinking the water, listening to the music, watching the movies and the television. Just because you feel that you're awake doesn't mean that other people are. Like, I don't think I'm awake. I think I'm conscious of and beginning to gain more understanding and power with each passing day. But I would never call myself woke or anything, you know, of that nature. But depending on the type of people you're talking about and the things that they're consuming, they're not as aware of things as you are. So you're thinking that they should act in a way that you would react as an aware person, when they're not. Those people that are sagging and gang banging and selling drugs, they're not at a high frequency.
Yeah.
They need us to kind of help them raise their frequency so that we can make more progress. So I am not surprised at all that they will believe something like that, because yeah, very susceptible to the programming and the trickery mm-hmm. that you know, the white race is imposing upon them.
And the whole narrative is so washed, because the two little white kids that just shot at the police, they were like, they're sweet. Even though they grew up in foster care and they have been, you know, they put up the most perfect pictures of them. And they said that, you know, they're really sweet kids. They just got lost in the system. But then right before that, no more than 2 weeks before that, there was a Spanish boy out at 2 o'clock in the morning, and he's running from the police and he's murdered by the police. And he gets told, well, why was he out at 3 o'clock in the morning? And well, we shouldn't have been shooting at the, he was like, that never happened. He was running from the police. He threw the gun. He put his hands up and he's dead. So it's like the narrative is always getting on my nerves at this point. And no one is speaking up about it. Like,
yes, they are. The narrative is part of white supremacy, and the conscious people that I follow on social media and even myself. See, like, I think you told me about the Spanish one. You said that's the one where you say he threw the gun in the fenced area. Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah.
But the other one that you're talking about, the two white kids, I'm stopped watching that stuff. I don't even know what that is, but that is how white supremacy works. And you and I have talked about that. Every time it's a white person, they have a mental issue. They show a sweet cherubic picture. Excuse me, every time it's a black person, they could be a college grad, they could be a PhD. They're gonna show a mugshot. They're gonna go back to some time at sixth grade where they stole a pack of gum and start to, that's what they do. That's what this whole system is about.
So how do we all band together and don't listen and make sure that we get treated? Because I feel like we call it out more. If a black person does something horribly wrong, we call it out. We don't sugarcoat it. We don't sugarcoat what they call SHIT. We don't do that. We'll say it, you know, wrong is wrong. But I feel like no one else is doing that. No other race is doing that. So how do we get on code so we can say, look, y'all start calling out yours, we're gonna start calling out ours. Somewhere we're gonna meet up in the middle.
Well, the first thing is, I don't think they're gonna start calling out theirs. I think that their numbers are dwindling, their fear is rising, and it's only gonna get worse before it gets better. Number two, I think that we just have to come together and make a decision that and have an understanding that until all of us are okay, none of us is going to be okay. Until Africa is strong and sovereign and debt-free and in power, none of us are going to be okay. And if we want to call somebody out, we call them out within the group. We do not expose that to people outside of the group.
Hey.
And we don't ridicule people. We don't put them down. It's just, it's almost like, girl, it's almost like we need to just write a list of rules.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we do. This is what we don't. And this is where and how we can do it. Everybody needs to get on board. And then I think individually we need, and this is what I'm always preaching, we need people to put down the McDonald's.
Yeah.
We need people to eat fruits and vegetables, because those things open your vision. I'm telling you that stuff makes you more susceptible to the programming. When you get food and water, your brain starts thinking and receiving and processing. And so that's part of the message. You know, like, oh my God, there's some videos that I saw, just fun stuff. And I don't have a lot of time to watch videos, but you can't tell because that's what we happen to be talking about. But it was about food all around the globe. Did you see that? There was a little black boy, white girl, an older white girl and her brother. It was really good. Nothing really to do about race. And they show food from Australia, from Britain, from America, from Italy, Brazil.
I was embarrassed of America's food, though.
Jamaica. You know what? I commented that. Yeah. I commented that it is astonishing to me how every other country fed their kids real healthy food, and American schools fed their kids junk. that doesn't even qualify as
food. GMOs, when you know about it, it's so heartbreaking. When you know that watermelon, we grew up with watermelon with seeds in it. We grew up with lemons with seeds in it, grapes with seeds, the whole net. When you find out that they removed all of that for whatever reason and it took out the nutrition, it just makes you think like, are you kidding me? Like I go
to think like I'm eating that. All my watermelon, I haven't had any watermelon this season yet because I haven't found seeded yet. When I do, I'll keep going back. We'll get one, we'll keep going back. I'm not eating that mess, but that's not even what I'm talking about. Like, you know, in the other countries, they will feed their kids a meat, a vegetable, and some food, or some bread, and some food. Americans feed their people like nuggets and like crap.
But the food had an expiration date. Like the bread was only good for 3 days. You know, the tomatoes are only going to be good for maybe 3 or 4 days. And you look inside and it's beautiful. It's even, you know, everything about their food had an expiration
date. It was real.
Yeah, it was real.
It was real food.
Yeah.
It would be like, we had pasta bolognese with French bread and some fruit or jollof rice. They had one from Nigeria. They had like food that your parents would make at home and give you for dinner. They had some of that for lunch. Here, it was like, just like pizza, nuggets. I don't even remember what we had. I just remember I wrote that all those other countries fed their food, their kids real healthy food, and America just gave those kids junk food.
And I am definitely a slacker. Like I can go months, years without eating anything junk food. And then there it goes, pops in my brain and I'll go off to, you know, eat a hamburger or a turkey burger and just, you know, fall off. But I wish I could practice more what I preach, because I do know, like you say, the gift of fresh fruit, vegetables, good eating, lots of water. I know what it does to the brain. I've had it happen to me.
Burgers are okay. I spent years eating turkey burgers, ground chicken, ground turkey. I loved a good turkey burger. Don't get me around Bobby Flay's. There's a lot of places I would go for a bomb turkey burger. But I just think that it's more like balanced meals, staying away from fast food. But I'm an 80-20 person. Oh. So I probably typically average 80% really healthy, good for you food.
I am too. I'm not gonna lie.
One stuff that I want to eat, and I'm definitely not tomorrow. I'm gonna have a cookie. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I grew up, and I raised my kids the same way. Everything is at your fingertips, so nothing is taboo for them
or anything. Yeah. So that relieves food issues.
Yeah, they don't crave for Doritos. They don't crave for chips and candy and none of that, because if they want it, it was always right there. So it's never
right now. It's in. We got chips and all kind of stuff.
They go bad before they literally.
Even as we have peaches and plums and all that other stuff, oranges and stuff in the pantry too. I mean, not in the pantry, in the fridge and the freezer. I like sweets, so we've always had that. I taught my kids to eat a serving. I may have told you that story that my son went over for a play date to his friend's house. This was late elementary school. And the mom said that they could have some cookies. And she called me later and said that Jordan said, that's not a serving. And so he just got himself a serving. I taught them to look on the package and see what a serving is and have a serving. So it wasn't off limits, but you weren't gorging either. Oh, you want some chocolate chip? Go ahead and get yourself a serving. And then like before bed, we're gonna have fruit. We always ended the night with fruit. So, but she thought it was so hilarious. And she said, yeah, Kim, Jordan said, that's not a serving. And she started laughing. I was like,
he had gotten more than he needed.
Yeah, he had gotten more than a serving.
That is so awesome. Well, I'm like that now, and I have been like that for many years because my kids are allergic to everything. So I've always had to read the back of a package for every single thing. So now it's just natural for all of us to read the back of everything. Because
that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. So there's something else totally off topic of this topic. It's relevant to what we're talking. Oh, the one last thing I did want to say is that, I'm just setting the alarm, is that those white people on that video, I mean, I thought that video was good because, again, it reminded me of all the good white people. I just don't know what else to call them, but the good white people I've known in my life. And it reminded me that many of them are our allies. And I need to be aware of that. I don't need to do anything different, but I need to be aware of that and to receive them maybe. Mm-hmm. Accordingly, because at the end of that video, they start talking about, I'm going to keep getting the benefits.
Yeah.
They're saying, like, there's nothing I can do.
They did say that.
They said, they admitted that the white supremacy is in every institution in this country, it's embedded in it and all of that. But the ones at the end were saying, I'm going to keep getting the benefits because I can't stop it. That's just how the system works. But I'm going to work to change it. Yeah. And then I thought about you, and I thought about my best friend from high school, who's always, we have a big difference of opinion because I am into Black versus white because this is who I am. And yeah. She's not about Black and white. It's about those who are for humanity and all this stuff. But I did think about both of you, and you are two of the ones I sent it to, because I said, you know, if there are whites like this who are determined to work to break down the very system that's unfairly elevating them, then those are the people that I would accept them wholeheartedly. They could come in and out of my life as at will. I would participate in theirs because that's a different kind. And I think that's what I texted you. These are different kind of white people, but I have met them and I do know they exist. They're not just on that video. I have known them in my life. So that was really positive for me to see that and to be reminded of that. But you wanted to talk about, and this is just something totally different that we can wrap up with, old comedy versus new comedy and whether the world of comedy has become more boring in light of cancel culture.
Yes, I was watching some, I love comedy. I love all comedy. And I was watching old comedy like Robin Williams, Robin Harris, Richard Pryor.
How fast he died. He had just hit it. Robin Harris.
And he was hilarious. Yeah. Hilarious. And he didn't even give himself enough, you know, time to prosper. I mean, demons.
Earl didn't give him time. He died. He didn't kill himself either, right?
He had a drug overdose.
Was a drug overdose?
It was a drug overdose. And not to skip the subject, but once people start making money, you have a better quality drug dealer who has a higher grade of drugs, who your system might be used to the weak stuff. So people just don't realize that. And it's always somebody out there who's looking at you as a moneymaker. The drug dealer is looking at you like, if I could just get this one person on, he'll put me on with all his drug addict other rich friends. And it's like a sick ball game out there. But
I recall that he died. It was like shortly after Bebe's kid.
He was in a hotel
to be real popular, and then bam, he was gone.
Yeah, I believe it was his hotel room. Also, they found him in, and he was, you know, it had been drug related.
And so, you think that the older, would that include Bernie Mac in the older comics?
Yeah, he was the ones I was talking about that was, you know, older, not as old as the rest of them, not like the Richard Pryors and George Collins and people.
Actually, I love him. He was so woke. You want to talk about a woke white man?
He was so woke. Such a beautiful comedian on all aspects. And I love them.
I love a clever, like, you know, my kids and I'll be like, that was clever. Like in their raps, their comedy. And I like cleverness.
There's a newer comedian, Bill Barr, who's almost like he triumphs in that era of the George, and he's very good. He's very woke also. He's also married to, he's a Caucasian man married to a Black woman. And amazing comedian. And so it's some out there who are still and can hit on the notes that are making everyone uncomfortable, but also funny.
Eddie Griffin, Dave Chappelle, Eddie Griffin, sometimes Cat Williams, they go deep.
Yeah, I believe they go deep, but not if you compare it to old school comedy. Like David Chappelle does, he gets off the, I will give him his props because he definitely is a woke comedian that definitely wants to get the agenda across. However, compared to like all the rest, like the Eddie Murphys and the, when he was at his finest, and they said things that make people cringe now. And oh, that's, you know, like they even wanted Kevin Hart to apologize to the gay community for his, it's like, stop it, people, shut up.
It's gay here.
It's raining. It's physical. Well, what if he said that about women? I don't give a darn, it's comedy. He can say it about anybody he wants. He can say it about children, women, whatever he wants. It's comedy.
If it's laugh or turn it off. It's right. Just entertainment. Either you like it or you don't. If it offends you, turn that thing off.
Get off.
Just the way I don't watch horror. I love comedy because I want to be entertained. I want to laugh. And when it's done, oh my God, that was so good. And I love comedy.
Absolutely.
Can I just ask you, is it gay year or was it gay? Is June Gay Pride Month? Because all I've been seeing is gay.
June is Gay Pride Month and they are wearing it well.
It's on the radio. It's every time, it's like, I mean, it's okay. That's their
first. I remember Don Lemon saying, and it's Gay Pride Month. And I was just like, oh, well, thanks for telling me.
Remember John Belushi? And I mean, they're just been, Curtin was hilarious. It doesn't have to be all black. They're just, people, we've had so many phenomenal comedians over the years.
We have, and like I said, if you watch old SNL, what we called it Saturday Night Live, they call it SNL, but
Saturday Night Live.
If you watch it, you would, the new school era, you couldn't get through it. You would be appalled by everything they do. So I just
want... I will be appalled or society?
No, not you, people.
Oh, you mean people. It's so touchy these days.
Yeah. I'm so elusive with the word you, but yeah, I'm telling you.
We all are.
If you watch old comedy versus new comedy, it's so, some people are scratching at the, you know, surface of like trying to break through and start saying stuff, but it's still like, you finish the comedy off in your head to almost like, it would have been better if you had said this, or you should have said that, but they'll hold back because they don't want to get canceled by this cancel culture. And I don't know who these people are. I don't know how they come about, but I just can't wait for everyone to just get their nerves back.
Get their panties out of a bunch and make them woman up and let us have some adult, I have to say, I recently gone to see Dave Chappelle. I will still go to a comedy show, but like there was a time when we would go to local comedy.
Oh yeah.
I saw some more at the Improv, and I didn't even watch that kind of comedy. I never watched a BET comedian. Yeah, oh my God, she was hilarious. It was so good, but there's like a local comedy circuit that we used to go to, and I stopped going because they start telling so many adult jokes about sexuality.
No, I don't like those comedians.
I don't want to hear all that. I want to hear, it can be deep, it can involve sex, but it can't just be little cheap punchlines about, you know, sex and movements, and I don't want to hear that. So I had stopped going. It was a lot about fellatio
and they don't laugh. I know exactly what comedians you're talking about, and they do
stop going. But I still go see the national people. Like I was like Cat Williams. Oh, he is a fool. I will go see him and be cracking. They have you crying.
Yeah.
And like, oh my God, my stomach hurts. It is so fun.
And to me, it's therapeutic because I think so hard in life that it can take my mind off of thinking for a short period of time to give me a break. I feel like it's that my brain is exercising and we're having a good workout. So I like that. That's what comedy does to me. I'm at my lowest times in life, even my highest, of course, but my lowest times in life, comedy has brought me through.
music can do that for me too. I've always been really big on music. Music can accentuate your sadness if you want to wallow in it, but it can lift you up and make a fun experience even more. Yes. But I think that art, and like, you know, I used to read novels all the time. I used to read like 5 or 7 novels a week from middle school. Huh?
I said, bless your heart. I wish I could do that. I wish my brain when I read drifts off.
It takes you to a whole new world. I can't tell you how many places I've traveled to, how many new things I've learned about. But I haven't read a novel in 10 years. I mean, once I started really...
Yeah, I heard the Michelle Obama and
that's not a novel. That's nonfiction.
Yeah, that's nonfiction, but...
I don't want to read
that. That was the last book I've read. And I've had several others upstairs I need to actually read, but...
Actually, I need to get back into that. I would just curl up and read. Yeah. My son used to read a lot, but by the time my daughter came, I didn't have time. So she does read, but she wasn't as big of a reader as I used to be. Yeah. She just didn't see it.
Well, they were with all the books of their era, but I had them reading The Coldest Winter Ever right now. So I can't wait for them.
Oh, I loved that. But I heard that part two is a little weird. Did you read the second part?
No, I'm not a... Sister Soldier is somewhere.
She's different.
Very different.
Not talking about that was a good book. Waiting to Exhale was a good book.
I read all of her books.
You know, it was a good book. I used to read her too. What was a good book, like when I was growing up, like Freaky Friday.
Oh, yeah.
The movies. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, the book would come out first. I will have read the book. Mm-hmm. And then they'll say, we're making a movie. Mm-hmm. And you go see the movie and see... Did it compare with how you imagined it in your mind?
When I was younger, I read the book, and it was like the Joy Luck Club. People was always like, I read the book. Right, and then I read the book, and then I saw the movie, but the movie to me was so much better. I was like, thank God.
So much better to me, but that's because the books usually come out years before the movie. Yeah. So if you do it later and then you read the book and see the movie, it might be different. But when you read the book and live with the book, and then the movie comes out some years down the road, it might be a little.
I actually stole some things from that book. Like at any given time, I tell my kids that they're my favorite, and they always throw it in my face. Oh, you say that was, but I love the fact in that movie how the mother at the end, they found out like she told all of us we were the favorite. I just love that moment. Like,
you do that? Oh, you did that? You told your kids?
I do it all the time to my kids, and they know it now because they've all confided in each other. It was like, you know, I feel bad that, you know, I'm mom's favorite. No, you're not her favorite. I'm her favorite. Like, they all stabbed me.
I never did that. You know, with my kids, I always made a point of telling them, neither one of you is my favorite. I love you both. And I mean, it was a big deal in my house for it. You know, I never wanted anybody, you let her do this. Now, that's not to say they didn't do that, or you let him do that, but it was clear. No, I don't have a favorite. I got a favorite daughter and a favorite son, and both of you are my favorite equally.
Yeah, I think all my kids at this point in time in their life knows I don't have a favorite anything. Like, they know they're all evenly yoked. So, I can say it, and it means nothing to any of them. So, but
a lot of kids don't grow up in that kind of family, and it messes them up.
Yeah, no, it does. I actually talked about that on another show of mine, but I talked about how my mother had, and she still does.
You told me that, yeah.
Yeah, we nipped on it a little bit, but we'll bring her on this show and she can talk about it more.
That happened to my mother. I'm sure she won't come on this show, but that happened to her. And truthfully, over decades, mm-hmm. I don't think she's ever gotten over it. And I think that it forever colored how she sees the world, having been treated, at least in her mind, and probably from what I can see, I think it may be true, having been treated differently than the rest of her siblings.
Wow.
Never.
I'm blessed. My mother's a pain, and I'm so blessed that I'm not her favorite, because I don't
get over it.
I don't get burdened with her presence in my life. Like, she's a handful. So. Oh. People that she, like my sister complained, my brothers complained. I don't ever have to complain because she doesn't. So I'm like, thank you, Jesus.
And the one thing I would like to see for you, I wasn't aware of this, but based on this conversation here, don't let white supremacy weigh you down about your blackness. It's a beautiful blessing. And, you know, I don't even, we'll talk about that another time, but I don't let them get inside my head. I don't carry the weight of the world on my shoulders. The only thing I carry
is I want to change people. I want them to see what I see from who I am and what people like me are. And I want them to know, like, if you only knew the beauty of just seeing people as good people and bad people, or, you know, I feel like they're shortchanging their life, and they would be so much. I've heard Maya Angelou say this, that when she was growing up, she always felt white people were so mean and vicious and lips were always tucked in. And she said, what, black people were just so spiritual, and how you doing? And hey, how's everything?
And all that, yeah.
And my thing is this, I feel like if you only knew, it's okay to really laugh, to gut-wrenchingly throw your head back, laugh.
A lot of them are like that. And then some of that is not their culture, but I'm saying, I think the difference is you want to change white people. And that's the burden.
I have changed, and the ones that I've seen, when I say laugh, that's like a figurative of speech, meaning like, you're not tight. You don't have a stick up your butt. You're not tight. You can genuinely hug your kids and crunch them in your arms and feel the exchange. You're not just...
I know people like that. But I want to change black people. And maybe that's why I don't feel the way you feel. I don't want to change anybody, but I want to help black people understand who they are and feel the power of it and the magnificence of it, and to understand how great we are and how, see, and we gotta go. We'll talk about this another time, because we have been on here a good minute. But I think the difference of the pressure you may feel versus me not feeling any is that I'm focused more on people who look like me.
Right.
You're focused on people who don't look like us. And I'll say what I always say, we need both.
Own it. If we can change them to teach us where you're originally from, what you originally are capable of, I feel like then that changes the world. I feel like trying to teach us against the firm, it's just never going
No. Nothing. Well, see, first of all, I'm going to say, I think we need both. I think there's some room for somebody like you over there working with them, and there's some room for somebody like me. But in my mind, I am perfectly clear that as soon as we remember who we are and understand who we are, the entire world changes. The only reason they can have us in this grip of white supremacy and do the things they've done to us is because in Africa, where they were colonized, in America, and across the diaspora, where we were enslaved, we were made to forget who we are, to begin worshiping white gods, to do all kinds of things that are fundamentally at odds with who we are. And the minute we remember and live in our power is the minute the world changes. So for me, that's the priority. But I don't think that, I mean, I think that for us to have people who are doing what you're doing is very useful too.
I mean, you look at Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. I look at them because I say she changed that part of the world forever. They have literally have had talks all week, all month about how they need to make the palace more diverse now. Like, what? What are you talking about diverse? There's no color in there. They need to diversify. And I feel like her love, the love he has for her, the obsession he has for her is trans, and they can't deny it. Like, they're pounding their heads against the cement. Like, stop loving this black woman this much. What do you see in her? Why is she so great? How can you just denounce your whole family for this black woman? And that alone, to me, is showing, and him open to that, him opening to, look, I don't care about what race I am. I don't care. My mother was dating a man who was black, and she was murdered for it, and you're not going to murder my black woman.
He wasn't black.
That Dodi Fayed?
He wasn't black. He was some kind of Middle Eastern Arab. They're not black.
Egyptians? You do the DNA.
They're not black right now. They were black. Historically, they were black.
The government would do that DNA test. I bet you it's going
to. I doubt it. I doubt it. I bet you he comes from the same way Jews are from Ashkenazi and all. I doubt it. Same problem we have here. The Native Americans were Blacks. They're $5 white Indians now. I don't know. What I do know is that I don't watch that stuff, and it is a form of programming. Nothing has changed in the royal family.
No, because it's been that way for hundreds and hundreds of years. But what I'm saying is, as we stand today, the conversation that would have never even happened is starting to happen from this one strong Black woman who stood firm and said, I'm not having this. And it's
you gotta look back at history. There were Black people in the royal family back in history. This is not
over on history. Now we on prime time where everybody can see this man who loves this woman and this woman who loves this man, and they're doing everything to make sure that their family is shown in love, and it's opening the doors to everything.
I think we should stop here. I don't see any of that any other way you see it. I see that as a whitewash fairy tale that they're pretending, that is just programming you more. I don't think any of that. I think that and I'll watch it, but the little stuff I heard, I think that she was clear that they were concerned that their little baby Archie or whatever his name is, his skin would be too dark. They treated her a certain way because she was Black, and all the rest of that fairy tale BS is BS, because if it wasn't, he wouldn't have left. The whole of British society treated her away. You have to read those. I mean, I'm sure you watched it.
I feel like he left for the love and protection of his family. Like, look, I don't care what title I'm stripped of. I love my wife. I love this woman, and I'm rolling with her. You know, and he could have easily, you know, been like anybody else in the past. I'm like, look, okay, they don't want me to marry a Black woman. I'm not going to marry her, even though I'm in love. I'll sneak behind, you know, what is his name? Thomas Jefferson. I'll put it in the basement and sneak behind the world back. But he didn't. He's like,
Let it go here, because I think a part of it is I don't care enough about the royal family or any. I mean, my priority is just not white people. I don't care enough about that to care. I don't care. I don't care what the hell Prince Harry is showing and what people are thinking. What I care about is, can we get ourselves together? Can we reclaim our culture? Can we reclaim our power and our strength so that we can be better in this world? But I mean, your mission is to change white people. So I guess you care. I don't watch that stuff and I don't buy it. And I think that I know that the news is propaganda.
We both have to change. But I just feel like that the door has been closed so long. And I just feel like I'm one of those people that just want to go through and open all of the doors and tell them to come out and look and endure all the pain that you're going to endure finding out that, you know, your history was lied to, and just deal with it.
Well, let's talk about that next time, because we've got to wrap up. Any parting? And I just think we're on such a different size of the fence on this, and I think that's okay. And I bet you there are a lot of people out there who believe exactly what you believe, and a lot of people out there who are right in my lane. Like, you tell them, sis.
Absolutely. So
if anybody would have comments or suggestions or anything, I mean, we'd be happy to hear them. But you know, I think this was good to air this out. Is there anything else that you want to share with the audience today?
Oh, I think we had a great discussion. I think this is the painful truth that we have to talk about.
Perfect. Well, thank you all for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you.
All right. Good night.
Good night.